Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Wine can be many things to many people. Maybe a way to celebrate, maybe a thirst quencher, maybe a food enhancer, an everyday drink of choice. Basically, if you like it, you drink it. If you don't, you won't. It's not that simple for a connoisseur. Author and journalist Bianca Bosker delved into the world of wine experts to write her new book. It's entitled Cork Dork, A Wine-Fueled Adventure Among the Obsessive Sommeliers, Big Bottle Hunters, and Rogue Scientists Who Taught Me How to Live for Taste. She joins us now. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much for having me back. It's such a pleasure to be here.
I was confused about how to pronounce sommelier in plural.
Sommeliers.
Okay. All right.
You could also just say psalms and kind of just get past the whole thing altogether.
Psalms. Okay. I think I might do that. Bianca, I say welcome back, but that's because the last several times we talked, it was for a technology segment.
Well, that was my previous life as the executive tech editor at the Huffington Post, which for a variety of reasons I abandoned in order to start over as a cellar rat, which is the lowest of the low in the wine world, and then trained to become a sommelier.
I always like it when people write a book like yours and they start out and they go back in history and talk about Psalms in their earliest forms. And that was a pretty scary thing.
Yeah. So as I embarked on the journey that led to my book, Cork Dork, so I basically, you know, again, started over in the wine world and then decided basically that I didn't want to just write about these cork dorks, which is the restaurant industry's nickname for the most passionate and obsessive wine lovers. I actually wanted to become one of these cork dorks. And I have to say, I was got curious in the history of the sommelier. And I have to be honest, I figured I would go to the library, go to my local bookstore, pick out a couple of books about the history of the sommelier, read them, summarize, you know, end of story. No. As it turned out, no one had really written the history of the sommelier, which I found so interesting because if you actually go back, sommeliers have been with us since the ancient Egyptians. And in fact, the people who we really always had a dedicated person to choose and serve wines. And in fact, that person has generally enjoyed a rather privileged status relative to other servers or servants or wait staff. And to my mind, can begin to tell us something about why sommeliers have a little bit of a stuck-up reputation. But yeah, we had the ancient Egyptians had their version of sommeliers, the ancient Romans, British and French royalty, of course, all the way through to the present day.
They were sort of like beasts of burden in a way, weren't they?
Well, the original name, so sommier, which gave us the word sommelier, was an ancient French word for, yes, basically the beast of burden. And yet, again, the person who actually handled the wine always had a kind of special status. I mean, wine was considered for a long time to be something with divine origins. It was a gift from the gods. And by extension, the people that handled it were also special. But it's also true that the early sommeliers kind of performed their task with all the charm of a beast of burden. Mm-hmm. So early on, the restaurants, which were actually invented, sommeliers were often failed chefs who got booted from the kitchen into the cellar and you know, were as thrilled about their new job handling wine as you might imagine.
Because they were rejects.
Basically, this is not their plan. It was sort of plan C in their career trajectory.
Now, there's another word, enophile.
Mm-hmm.
What's that?
So that is a fancy way of saying wine lover.
Okay.
Yeah.
It could be a professional wine lover, or it could just be...
Well, I have to say that this was something that I thought a lot about. I mean, I am a writer, you know, deep down. And so words mean a lot to me. Mm-hmm. And I think that when you get into the wine world, you do have to deal with a lot of almost impenetrable verbiage, right? Enophile, terroir, minerality, sommelier, these things that are difficult to pronounce and at times really vague in their meaning. And I will say that that was, in some ways, the beginning of what I reacted against as I pursued this journey to become a sommelier, because I was very conscious early on of really wanting to go beyond the pretension, to pull back the curtain on parts of the wine world that we don't hear about, that don't get explored. Because I think that so often what these fancy terms, you know, go along with is the fact that we get a very romanticized version of the wine world, right? We hear a lot about tradition, romance, these fourth-generation winemakers with their goat pets who are pooping on the vineyards and lending it these beautiful flavors. And in fact, the reality is way messier, way more complex, and way more interesting. And so for me, that manifested in everything from going behind the scenes in Michelin star restaurants to look at the way these places are actually judging you more than you judge mm-hmm. them, to mass market wine factories to look at the way that the wines that most of us drink are actually less made and more engineered.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about wine loving in the most intense, the most obsessive way ever. The people, I guess the creme de la creme, but I don't know, when you write about them, Bianca Bosker, it definitely takes away, it takes the gild off the lily. Bianca Bosker, she's the author of a new book. It's entitled Cork Dork, A Wine-Fueled Adventure Among the Obsessive Sommeliers, big bottle hunters, and rogue scientists who taught me to live for taste. Is this all been, in a good way, different for you? Are you happier?
Oh, yeah. Well, I will say it has had its ups and downs. So what happened for me is I think everyone has their wine epiphanies, but for most people that tends to happen in a beautiful part of the world with a beautiful glass of wine sitting across from a beautiful human being. My wine epiphany happened at a computer screen, which was appropriate because, you know, at that point in my life, I'd spent quite a few years as the executive tech editor for an online website. And it started because I heard about something called the Best Sommelier in the World competition. And I basically got obsessed with binge-watching YouTube videos of this Best Sommelier in the World competition, which, if you haven't seen it, is essentially the Westminster dog show with booze. And it was, for me, this window into this world of cork dorks, you know, these people that turn wine, which is ostensibly a thing of pleasure, into sheer god-awful pain. You know, they lick rocks to train their palates. They divorce their spouses to spend more time studying. And I was intrigued by this obsession because I had never felt my spirit moved by a glass of fermented grape juice. And I wanted to know, what was the big deal about wine? And critically, could I develop the sort of super senses that these people had? I mean, they could smell and taste things in a way I'd only ever associate with bomb-sniffing dogs at airports. And I decided to find out. So, yeah, against all the better judgment of those who love me, I quit my job, as you know, my stable, steady job as the tech editor, and essentially started drinking very heavily in my attempt to become a sommelier. And I say it has its ups and downs because I realized very quickly that sommeliers had a word for people like me. I was a civilian. I was an outsider. I was not welcome in their inner sanctum, and I had to prove myself. And so the journey, you know, had its certainly its fair amount of hazing by my somm mentors who took me into their blind tasting groups. I spent a rough couple of months working as a cellar rat, sort of doing death-defying stunts on ladders with cases of wine. But it also brought me, you know, dissecting brains with neuroscientists, getting my brain scanned, going to wine orgies for the mega rich. So there were a lot of highs and lows, but I will say that, and there was a lot of hard work. I mean, again, I think that at this level, wine becomes less a job than a way of life, and that was certainly true for me. But I will say that it ultimately had a hugely positive effect on my life. you know, we've all heard of mindfulness, but I came out of this experience valuing what I describe as sensefulness, which is this idea that it's by tuning into our senses and savoring our senses that we can better learn to make sense of the world. And for me, that started with a glass of wine, that idea of training our senses, learning to listen to these ignored and forgotten senses of taste and smell. That can start with a glass of wine, but the rewards don't end there. There were some beastly hangovers along the way, but it was worth it.
And then you learned to spit.
Indeed. I did show up to my first blind tasting group fully confident, ready to learn how to taste. And as it turned out, I wasn't even ready for that. I mean, the first thing was to learn how to spit. I got very deep coaching on spitting with confidence, which required a lot of practice with mouthwash and water at the kitchen sink, before I actually was told to give up mouthwash
right.
because it was interfering with my palate.
Yeah.
The double spit, the idea being that you absorb as little alcohol as possible, which, by the way, after like six glasses, it still seeps in there.
Yeah, I would think so. Yeah. And you also talked just about, and this I could relate to, that when you were first starting the blind tastings, everything just starts tasting alike, or you taste the same thing over and over again. You only have those taste buds, such as they are, for a certain amount of time, especially when you're a beginner.
Absolutely. I think we can quickly fatigue our taste buds and our sense of smell. It's funny, the smell is our body's alarm system. And our sense of smell is designed to quickly adapt to odors in our environment. Now, this can be a very good thing when you're sitting next to someone on a plane that hasn't used deodorant. The smell will become less noticeable over time because you've adapted to it, basically. This becomes less helpful when you are fighting the clock to figure out in a blind tasting, what grape the wine was made with, what year and where, down to some tiny corner of the planet, not country, but vineyard. And after a couple of sniffs, the aroma of the wine could be less acute. And so what I suggest doing to that place is you kind of have to shock your nose back into it. And so basically, you can try smelling anything else, your arm, the person sitting next to you, a cup of coffee beans. I'm sure you've had the experience of going and picking out, let's say, perfumes, and they often have a little jar of coffee beans. And the idea there is that by sniffing something else, you can kind of restart your sense of smell to pick up on the aromas that you've become immune to over a couple of sniffs.
You wrote briefly about what philosophers thought about the senses and what mattered and what didn't. And taste and smell were considered the lower senses.
Oh, yes. I'm so glad you brought that up. So what I found really intriguing was basically starting with Plato and Aristotle. They decided that taste and smell were the animalistic base senses. And by the way, humans were bad at them anyways. They didn't matter. And I think that view, more than many of us realize, has really infected philosophy, science, our everyday lives. If you think about it, growing up, we are taught to identify the color of a fire truck or the sound that the cow makes or the fact that if you touch a stove, it's hot. And yet, we really are never encouraged to listen to our nose, to begin to describe and put words on smells. And as a result, I think many of us basically ignore them. More than that, we assume that we have a bad sense of smell. So as I write about in my book, there was this otherwise brilliant French neuroscientist who discovered what he claimed was proof that humans had unlearned how to smell, right? There's this idea that as we began to walk upright, humans lost their sense of smell and that we're way worse than all kinds of different animals. Well, as it turns out, recent research shows that we're actually much better smellers than we give ourselves credit for. We beat rats and even dogs when it comes to certain odors. So you know, far from being the worst sniffers, we actually beat animals long considered the uber noses. And secondly, we can actually improve our senses of taste and smell. So with a little bit of effort and training, by building up our sense memories, we can actually do better. And I think that there's this part of what attracted me to this world of sommeliers is that they took that anti-sense sensibility and threw that logic on its head. I mean, I came to this world from tech. My people were Soylent people. They believed in the body should be this obsolete thing replaced by virtual reality. And yet, you know, there was like something about this world of wine was so appealing to me because I realized that it didn't have to be a life of sensory deprivation. It could be a life of sensory cultivation. Here were people who believed in honing their senses to pay attention to these physical pleasures. And I wanted to know, what was I missing? You know, could I do what they did? My world felt so sterile by comparison. And when I think about my pre-cork dork time, it was sterile. I mean, there's a certain liability to honing your sense of smell when you live in New York like I do and you take the subway on a regular basis. But in the grand scheme of things, it's worth it. There's beauty in information that now reveals itself in ways it never did before.
My guest is Bianca Bosker. She's the author of a new book entitled Cork Dork, A Wine-Fueled Adventure Among the Obsessive Sommeliers, Big Bottle Hunters, and Rogue Scientists Who Taught Me to Live for Taste. If you have a question or comment for Bianca, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org or check out our Facebook page. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the art and science and obsession of wine and wine tasting. Still with us is author and journalist Bianca Bosker. Her new book is entitled Cork Dork, A Wine-Fueled Adventure Among the Obsessive Sommeliers, Big Bottle Hunters, and Rogue Scientists Who Taught Me How to Live for Taste. Thanks again, Bianca, for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I haven't finished the book yet. Are you still with your husband?
You know, will you believe it if I tell you that you are not the first person to ask me that question?
Yes, because anyone who's read halfway through like I have would say, what about him?
I had a lovely lady at a book reading come up to me and basically say the exact thing. As it turns out, my husband and I are still together. And as she points out, he is a saint.
Yeah.
But yeah, when your wife quits her steady job and goes from, you know, going most weekday mornings, sitting down by 9 a.m. to editorial meetings and genuinely being a constructive member of society, to what became my new routine, where I was most weekday mornings sitting down by 9 a.m. to my first 6 to 12 glasses of wine, drunk by 12:30, hungover by 2 p.m., and, you know, texting your husband at his job drunkenly from the subway. Yeah, it can wear thin after a while. But, you know, I will say that it was, you know, an absolutely all-consuming undertaking and endeavor. I mean, I rearranged my life around my senses as I pursued this cork dork path to becoming and working as a sommelier. And, you know, I gave up perfume, daytime sobriety, any food above a lukewarm temperature, brushing my teeth at certain times of day. And you're right that those things do not necessarily ingratiate you to your loved ones.
It was very interesting, the subculture of it, the foodie or of the wine lovers world in New York City. And I'm wondering, is it safe to say that in any moderate large foodie city such as Columbus, there's this subculture as well?
Absolutely. I mean, I've had the opportunity now that I've been on book tour and traveling around the country to really get to speak to wine lovers all over, and they really are all over. What I will say is I also, as I mentioned before, in Corkdork, I wanted to go beyond, I think a lot of wine books are sort of about fancy people drinking fancy wines and fancy mm-hmm. places. I wanted to go beyond that. Of course, there are glimpses of that, like my apprenticeship at this Michelin-starred restaurant in New York, a couple of them actually, along a stretch of Manhattan known as Billionaire's Row. I mean, there is a glimpse into what really happens. You know, these, as restaurants describe them, the wine PXs, right? Personne extraordinaire, who spend a whole lot of money on wine. And yet, I also had the chance to go beyond that. So when I took my certified sommelier exam, which is really the gold standard in the industry, I did so in a very different type of wine city, a place called Virginia Beach. And there I had the chance to work with a different type of sommelier. So this was a woman I met who was a really kind of partner and guide to me as we were cramming in our last few hours. And whereas a lot of somms and the people I follow and who became my mentors in the book come to wine as a calling, she came to wine really as a way of moving her family into the middle class. I mean, she had her first kid shortly after she graduated high school. She's married to a plumber. She had hopes of enlisting in the army and now actually works as a sommelier. And so I think for me, it was important, again, to show these different human sides of the wine world. And again, go beyond the fairy tale, because I think that it's more empowering. I think that the wine world has gotten by for too long on this preciousness. And I think that for me, you know, Corkdork has been important in terms of deviating from the wine world script. I mean, just looking at the way that wines are made, a lot of us, I think of wine as being this combination of grapes and yeast and love. And as it turns out, most of the wines that most of us drink are really this melange of additives. You know, there's about 62 different additives that you can put in wine to massage its flavor, its color, its mouthfeel. And, you know, that's just not the beautiful artisanal myth that we get sold. And it's something that I explore in the book.
Yeah, they don't list those ingredients on the
you
labels.
You don't have to. Right. Oh, no, by law, it's you actually don't have to. But as I explored, so I was very curious about this question of wine quality, what made mm-hmm. a wine good. And I was able to get this rare firsthand glimpse at the way that, much like flavor scientists designing new Frankenstein Oreo flavors, there are sensory scientists who are really designing and engineering new wine flavors. So they bring in groups of civilians, of sort of, you know, just regular wine drinkers, and have them taste wines. And if it turns out that people like, well, this year it seems that cherry cola aromas are in, well, that can be arranged. If it turns out that people want wines in a slightly darker purple shade, no problem. There's been a technological revolution in the winery. And I think that that's had it's not always been a bad thing. And in fact, more expensive wines also have this sort of manipulation going on. But it's something that people aren't aware of, and to my mind, they should be. I think that there's a lack of transparency that isn't good for anyone.
Let's talk about the people who make it to the top. You did pass your certification. How many people are we talking about? It's kind of like the PGA touring pros. It's just a fraction of a percent of all the people who ever play, right?
Right. Well, especially when you're talking about the upper level. So,
yeah.
The Court of Master Sommeliers has different level exams, and the top level is the Master Sommelier exam. And people can spend a decade or more of their life trying to pass just that test. There are fewer Master Sommeliers in the world than there are Navy SEALs. The exam has around a 95% fail rate. You have to pass 3 exams before you even can attempt that one. And I mean, people, just to give you a sense of the insanity, I mean, they will go years without eating anything that is, you know, hotter than lukewarm out of fear of burning their taste buds. They put maps on the inside of their showers so they can memorize grape growing regions while they're, you know, cleaning their hair. And these are the people who became my wine mentors. So I very quickly realized I didn't just, you know, I started off with a job as a cellar rat, mm-hmm. working in the industry. And then I was able to find some wine pros to really take me under their wing, to help me prepare for my exam as they were preparing for their own. And they are the most masochistic hedonists I've ever met in my life. I mean, they just put themselves through so much pain in the name of pleasure.
Tell us about Morgan. What shocked me about him was his age. After you described all these things about him, and then you said what his age was, I was shocked.
Yeah. So Morgan, for those who haven't read the book, is around my age, you know, so he's in his early 30s. And what I will say is I think a lot of people have this image, kind of stereotype of sommeliers as the judgy undertakers of the restaurant world. You know, they're these kind of older men and they're in these pinstripe suits and they've got scowls and they make you feel bad for not spending enough on wine. Mm-hmm. That is really changing. The new generation of somms are really younger, that coming at the job at a younger age than ever before. There are more women than ever before. A lot of them describe themselves as white-collar refugees who bring, you know, Stanford engineering degrees or PhDs in philosophy to the job of sommelier on the floor. And Morgan kind of falls into this camp. Now, I have to say that working as a tech editor, I was pretty sure that I was one of the foremost connoisseurs of nerdery, that like I knew all, I had seen every type of nerd under the sun. Well, Morgan, as it turns out, made me realize that there's an entire spectrum of nerd that I hadn't even discovered. I mean, he took it so far that he made it look cool. This is a guy who, you know, has thousands of flashcards. He lives for wine. And he also just has this passion. I mean, he made me want to stick my nose into whatever it was that he just tasted. He talks about wines that taste like male ballet dancer or, you know, the face that launched a thousand ships or, you know, over-baked garbage on a hot summer's day. And, you know, it sounds not super appetizing, but it makes you curious. And this is a guy who really combines a very, I think, philosophical and humanist perspective with his obsession with grape juice.
He is successful in his way, right?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I mean, he's training for the Master Sommelier exam. He's come a very long way in his wine career.
Is it so how did you get people like him, though, to take the time to do for you what he did?
Well, I think that part of the reason that people become sommeliers is that they want to share their passion. They want to bring other people to the joys of fermented grape juice. And so I think that, you know, in general, wine lovers, when people express an interest, they're eager to share their knowledge. So that was very helpful to me, and it got me into places that I think a lot of us don't get to see. I mean, as I mentioned, I got to go to what is one of the most extravagant gatherings of wine collectors anywhere on the planet. I mean, millions of dollars of wine show up to this dinner that happens every year. Working the floor of these Michelin star restaurants to see the behind the scenes. And, you know, I'm thankful. I think that it is a community that has a lot of love to give. And, you know, look, if you've ever sat next to someone like me, you know, like a real wine lover next to at a dinner party, you know that once we start talking about wine, it's very hard to shut us up.
But you weren't like that before.
No, not at all. I mean, are you kidding? There
yeah,
are people who...
So I do a reality check here.
My wine connoisseurship before I started to be on this path to becoming a sommelier extended to wine from a bottle versus wine from a box. That was about as sophisticated as my choices got.
So how have you changed now? I mean, can you drink cheap wine?
Well, I can drink cheap wine.
Notice you sniggered when I said that. I heard that.
I was going to say, I can drink cheap wine, but I'm less fond of bad wine. And those things are not always one and the same. I actually had just the other night a sort of very trendy bottle that was, you know, not totally inexpensive, and I couldn't even finish it. It was terrible. So you can find good wines that are cheap, and you can likewise, you know, find bad wines that are expensive. But look, when I started this, the only thing I got out of a glass of wine was drunk, period. Mm-hmm. And now, for me, wine is a pleasure that is physical, but also emotional, intellectual, even philosophical. I think that there's, you know, there are wines that make me wonder about my place in the world. They, you know, you can really travel through time and place in a glass of wine. And I think in order to do that, it actually begins with something as simple as building your sense memory. And what I mean by that is, I think, you know, when I started this, I could put my nose into a glass of wine, and on a really, really good day, I could tell you that I was smelling wine. Now, humans can perceive about 5 different tastes, but we can pick up, scientists think, around 1 trillion different odors. And so, you know, I think most of us assume that the thing that we do with wine is to drink it. Well, sort of. But actually, a lot of the nuance, the richness in that glass comes from its aromas. And you smell wine, you know, with your nostrils, but you smell it again in your mouth. It's called retronasal olfaction. There's a little passageway that connects from the roof of your mouth up back to your nose. And so I think that if you want to begin to discover those stories that exist in every glass of wine, I would say just begin building a kind of library of odors. A master perfumer gave me this advice, and I would share with everyone, which is to begin describing the smells of everything you encounter during the day. That could start with the smell of your shampoo in the morning, and it could end with, you know, the black pepper that you're putting into a meal at night, or the smell of your toothpaste when you're brushing your teeth before bed. But the critical thing is, again, it's basically the same thing as learning a language. You know, it's attaching meaning to aromas. And I think that'll help anyone become a more thoughtful connoisseur.
We're talking about the love of wine. My guest is Bianca Bosker. She's author of a new book. It's entitled Cork Dork, A Wine-Fueled Adventure Among the Obsessive Sommeliers, Big Bottle Hunters, and Rogue Scientists Who Taught Me to Live for Taste. We'll continue our conversation. If you have questions or comments, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org, or check out our Facebook page. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the art and science and obsession of wine and wine tasting. Still with us is author and journalist Bianca Bosker. Her new book is entitled Cork Dork, A Wine-Fueled Adventure Among the Obsessive Sommeliers, Big Bottle Hunters, and Rogue Scientists Who Taught Me How to Live for Taste. You wrote that competition has intensified, that the sort of unofficial apprenticeship system isn't what it once was among sommeliers.
Right. And so what is happening in the field is that traditionally people who wanted to become sommeliers, which is a job that, for those of you that aren't familiar with it, involves, in its most basic sense, picking and selling the wines for a restaurant. So picking out the wines that will be on the list and then selling them to customers. But I think the people that are best at their job are not just cork pullers, but also storytellers. You know, I think we think of chefs as being, you know, the really creative masterminds of the restaurant. And that's true, they are. But at the same time, sommeliers are creators in their own right. They create experiences and journeys through flavor. And I had a chance to witnessed that when I was doing my own version of an apprenticeship. So basically, I was combining trying to take and pass the Court of Master Sommeliers Certified Sommelier Exam, which recommends a minimum of 3 years in the wine industry, but I was giving myself a year to pass it. So I was combining that test with actual experience trailing somms on the floor of restaurants. And it was fascinating to watch the way that they were really analyzing the psychology, the emotions, the spending habits of their customers in order to figure out what to sell them. So we think a lot about, you know, I say this partially in my past role as a tech reporter. I think a lot of us are familiar with websites tracking us and trying to sell us things based on the data they gather. Well, it's happening offline, too. So in these top restaurants, a two-Michelin-star restaurant that I worked in on a stretch of New York called Billionaire's Row, and this restaurant would essentially collect data on their guests. So if you spent a lot of money, you would be labeled a wine PX, which is short for personne extraordinaire. If you spent a whole heck of a lot of money, you would be a PPX, which is personne particulièrement extraordinaire. If you threw a temper tantrum, you might be an HWC, which is short for handle with care, or SOE, which means sense of entitlement. And all of these codes were really used by the servers and the sommeliers in order to determine how they treated the guests. Now, of course, there could seem to be a mercenary piece of this, and it's a business, right? And of course, if, you know, other sommeliers in other restaurants talked about looking at the jewelry, the carats of the diamond rings, the designer bags, the luxury watches that the men wear, you know, all of these things to begin to gauge what is someone's budget. But on the other hand, there's also something more personal about this. You know, I don't think any of us would begrudge a regular who comes and spends tons of money at a restaurant wanting a little bit of a special treatment for that loyal patronage. And on the other hand, what it allows sommeliers to do is to deliver whatever it is really emotionally that a table wants out of a meal. Because when we go out to eat at these types of restaurants, it's really not just for the calories. It's also because we're looking for a particular type of moment or experience from this meal.
You, there's a lot of great information in your book, by the way. I mean, we're sort of talking about this emotional level a lot, but you talk about some really practical advice. And one is that I took to heart was I will never order a glass of wine again. I only order a bottle. Tell our listeners about how they price things on a menu and how they pick what goes by the glass versus what you can get by the bottle and all of that.
So essentially what I would say is if you are looking to buy a bottle of wine, whether you're in a restaurant or a wine store, and you don't know too much about what you want, don't despair. You really only need to give two pieces of information in order to drink a terrific bottle. One, how much do you want to spend? And two, what flavors do you want to taste? Now, the first one, I think we often shy away from saying our budget. If you don't want to say it out loud at the table, just, you know, point to a bottle on the list that you were thinking about that's in a price range you're comfortable with, and the sommelier will take a hint. Now, for the second one, about what flavors you want to taste, that could be as specific as saying, you know, I had a great Sauvignon Blanc from Slovenia the other night. Movia is the producer. What do you have like that? Or it could be as broad as saying, I like white wines that smell like peach. A good sommelier will be able to take either piece of information and direct you to a bottle. I would always suggest, you know, whether it's a sommelier, some restaurants just have servers, but they know a lot about wine. Don't be scared. Have a conversation. It's the fun part of a job when you're working the floor. I mean, otherwise, as you know, Morgan, one of my somm mentors, said, if people just order a bottle without asking, it can feel a little bit like you're just a, you know, vending machine robot. And so it is fun to get into that conversation, to take someone somewhere in a glass of wine.
Even if you're an ignoramus?
Oh, even more if you're an ignoramus.
Okay.
I, you know, when I was working the floor, as a psalm, I would have, you know, every night a table would come in and people would say, I really, you know, bring me a glass of whatever. I really can't taste the difference. And if I had time, and I didn't always, I would bring them back two glasses of two very different wines. And I would say, you can taste the difference, and here's how. And if I was lucky, you know, I would have that conversation once a week, maybe, on a really slow night. And I see Cork Dork, my book, as a way of really having that conversation that I had with sommeliers, only with, you know, tens or hundreds or, God willing, thousands of readers at a time. It's that idea of not telling people what to taste, but showing them how to taste. And if you feel that feels out of reach for you, part of it is just to start paying attention. When you drink a bottle of wine, just pay attention. What part of the world is it from, and what grape is it made with? And you can begin to figure out what you like and what you don't like, and then repeat that when you're ordering a bottle. Now, what I will say is it's worth being on the lookout for what sommeliers refer to as gimme wines. So most by-the-glass wine lists have these gimme wines, which are called that because people see them and they just think, give it to me, I don't care how much it costs. Mm-hmm. And the gimme wines are those instantly recognizable brand name grapes and regions. And if you order a gimme wine, you will likely pay a gimme tax. So people know that people go on autopilot and order them without thinking, without looking at the price. If you're looking to drink better wine for better value, I suggest picking the sort of intimidating wine, the thing that comes from a region you've never heard of, from a grape you can't pronounce, because in general, these are these hidden gems, these things that don't sell as easily, but the sommelier or wine director has put them on the list because someone loves these bottles. My first suggestion would be actually talk to the sommelier, but mm-hmm. barring that, live dangerously, drink dangerously. I mean, within reason, of course. I just mean try something different for a change.
and there's nothing on the list per se, you're saying, that they don't love. They're putting it there because they love it.
Yeah, I think for the best restaurants, that's definitely the case. You know, they don't have to be the most expensive restaurants, but yeah, they're there because they're on the list because someone believes in that bottle. I mean, I can tell you that behind the scenes, there are, you know, a dozen people laying their hands on that bottle of wine, moving it around the cellar, taking inventory, moving it from the box to the extra cellar to the current cellar, and they wouldn't be doing that unless they actually cared about that bottle.
As far as tasting the smell thing, I loved you describing when you were first learning how to smell. How you were soaking in, you know, bringing the fluid into your nose, sprinkling it out.
Spilling
yeah.
the wine,
oh,
getting it
so
all over.
Funny.
Yeah, you get up close and personal with that glass.
and the way you described how you behaved, but pouring the wine is a big hairy deal too.
Oh, absolutely. Well, I think that, as I said before, I had this kind of stereotype that wine was a pretty, you know, I'd heard about these wine competitions, and to be honest, it sounded like total BS to me. Because in my mind, I thought, you know, how can pouring wine possibly be high stakes? You open a bottle, you pour it, you're done. And as it turns out, I mean, I came to think of sommeliers as sort of being the ballerinas of the restaurant floor. It looks deceptively easy because it has to. The whole point is to take something fiendishly difficult and make it look effortlessly elegant. And so when you're working the floor, what you don't realize is that these psalms are juggling all kinds of fires and urgencies and picky guests and also rules. There are, I mean, the whole experience of training to become a sommelier just spoiled me on eating out because I became aware of all of these sets of rules and etiquette and decorum. You know, you can only pour open-handed, never backhand the guest, only walk clockwise around the table. You should only stand on a particular side of your guest. You must open a bottle of wine with a serviette in a certain place. And of course, it's a serviette and not a towel. I mean, most notably, there are something like a dozen rules for properly opening a bottle of champagne. And in case you're wondering, you should not hear it pop. ever. Very bad form. The noise that a bottle of sparkling wine makes as you remove the cork should be, and this is a technical term, mm-hmm. no louder than the queen passing gas. So you want a very gentle kind of noise.
Okay.
Yeah, it's
I'm writing this down. All the rules, but do they have some origin in making the wine or the whatever you're what making it taste better?
It's a great question. It's one that I had as well as I was spending time on the floor and preparing for my exam. So I wanted to know, you know, are these rules rational or do they solely exist for the purpose of making sommeliers memorize rules?
Right.
Well, in some cases, they are very rational. I mean, when you think about opening a bottle of sparkling wine is a loaded weapon. Those corks come out at a speed of 25 to 30 miles an hour. As one scientific paper very dryly noted, that there seems to be a uptick in cork-related eye injuries around the turn of the year. And so when you look at the proper procedure, yeah, there is. There's a reason that you have to keep your thumb on the cork, that you have to hold it at a particular angle, all these things to essentially ensure that you don't end up murdering someone with a bottle of sparkling wine and an errant cork. On the other hand, some of these things are, to my mind, more just tradition. So, for example, this idea of pouring open-handed. So, really, the proper procedure is that whenever you pour a bottle of wine, you should be with your palm of your hand facing the kind of face or body of your guest. Backhanding, incredibly rude. When I asked my mentors about it, the closest I got to an answer was basically something about biblical origins and, you know, a sign of trust. So I don't know about that one.
Okay. Yeah. So they can see that you're pouring only the wine into the glass.
Right. Well, I think it has to do with, I don't know, maybe so it doesn't. So it's sort of like you're hugging the guest is another way that it was described to me. You know, this open-handed, perhaps it just seems more, the body language is more inviting, more friendly. There's other things, though, that are really hotly debated. The idea of decanting a wine, for example. So if you take a bottle of wine and pour it into, you know, a decanter, or you could even use a vase, honestly. Mm-hmm. There's this idea that some people have that exposes the wine to oxygen and it helps open up its flavors. As it turns out, there's a lot of debate. There's one of the grand kind of minds of wine tasting argued that that was very hurtful to wine. It was too delicate for that. And then there's other people, you know, one of these big food science writers who argues in favor of taking an old Bordeaux and putting it in your blender, then whipping it to a froth, because that is the thing that does the best job in opening up its flavors. So I think that, you know, I would suggest that people, you know, you can familiarize yourself with the rules, but at the same time, rules in wine, like anywhere, exist to be broken. And I think that the most important thing is to figure out a way that you're deriving pleasure from a wine. And I think that that really does start with the sensory expertise. But more than that, you know, if you're not getting pleasure out of a wine, you're doing it wrong.
Do you still enjoy it? I mean, can you just hang around with your ordinary friends anymore and drink a bottle?
Well, I will say that when my friends come over to my house for dinner, they no longer bring wine. They bring like 6 packs of Bud Light in protest. But absolutely, I think that, of course, that there's the kind of critical side of my brain that's thinking about the wine, where it came from, what it has to say, decoding the flavors. But yet at the same time, by the maybe third glass, those are a little less acute. And I do. I really see a wine as something that can bring people together. And so it's been a joy for me to, I mean, just the other night, I had a bunch of friends over and opened a whole bunch of wines that I was very excited to try, because it's cool to kind of take other people's tastes and help them travel the world through a glass.
Bianca Bosker, thanks so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Bianca Bosker, author of a new book entitled Cork Dork, A Wine-Fueled Adventure Among the Obsessive Sommeliers, big bottle hunters, and rogue scientists who taught me to live for taste. That's it today. Thank you so much for your attention. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.